Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, clean energy legislation is stalled at the State House. Meanwhile, some communities are on edge. They're worried that without action, nuclear power plants that employ hundreds could shut down. The pandemic caused interruptions in learning this past year, and schools are worried about the possible long-term effects on students. We'll hear more. Restaurants are having difficulty finding enough workers. Some have had to close even during prime dining hours. What's it like for those still working in the food service industry?
Some people cuss at us, some people just leave. I would say for people to be more considerate to actually treat food service employees like people.
Also, we'll learn about a woman who saw problems with workplace safety and became a champion for workers' rights. Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, will the ethanol industry play a role in slowing climate change? Not everyone is convinced. What's the long-term impact of the pandemic on students? And we'll learn about a woman whose efforts greatly improved workplace safety. We'll have those stories and more this hour. Well, the clock is ticking for the state to pass a sweeping green energy law that would keep the nuclear power plants Byron and Dresden running. Peter Medlin has more on how the Byron community is feeling as time for compromise is running out.
Christine Lynn says her community feels powerless, despite being home to a nuclear plant that provides electricity to over 2 million Illinois homes. Lynn is the president of the Byron School Board, and she spent the last year signing witness slips and writing advocacy letters to lawmakers, stressing the urgency to save the plant.
I'm still optimistic, but I probably have never been more anxious.
Exelon announced plans last summer to shutter that power station and one in Dresden this September. The billion-dollar energy giant just filed paperwork to deactivate one of the two cooling towers at the Byron facility. Here's Exelon breaking down the science behind cooling towers and how nuclear is clean energy.
It's water vapor coming out of those cooling towers. No radioactivity, no pollution, no carbon. It's just water.
Pure H2O, which means zero emissions.
Byron residents have created a Byron Station Response Committee and a website called Save Illinois Nuclear Power. Former students have posted videos to the site talking about the opportunities they've had in Byron and how the nuclear plant plays a big role in supporting community programs.
Byron Station contributes greatly to our schools, forest preserves, recreational facilities, and so much more. There are a lot of impacts that would result in the closing of the Byron Station that you could see in studies and hear on the news. But I wanted to remind everyone that at the end of the day, it will affect a lot of people, people of every age.
Thousands of jobs are on the line, and Lynn says the ripple effects extend out to everything from business to education.
I'm on a school board where we have 74% of our income comes from the tax revenue from that plant. So, I mean, we will be hit hard. It will be devastating to us.
After the closure announcement, the Byron School District ran the numbers on what districts around them received in local taxes and state funding, and Lynn says it would take years to make up the funding, if not for immediate state intervention.
There is a fatal flaw in evidence-based funding formula, and that is it's not responsive. There is no metric for what you do when a district loses in the extreme amount that we would be losing.
She says they could use some of that immediate state intervention now. They had hoped that the Climate Union Jobs Act would pass during the legislative session, but that deadline came and went. Then lawmakers met in Springfield in early June, but still couldn't reconcile their differences over the bill.
All of the people, the environmentalists, the unions, the governor's office, the legislators, they all need to understand that there is a sense of urgency here.
Fossil fuels have been a major roadblock in the state negotiations, particularly as Illinois wants to phase them out by 2030. And the proposed bill would close the Prairie State coal plant in a bit over a decade.
I understand that those communities are probably in the same boat as we are, right? They rely on those generation facilities for their tax basis, for their work. But the phase out for them is not weeks, it's years.
If the nuclear stations close, it could set back the state's clean energy timeline. 54% of electricity in Illinois comes from nuclear. Illinois would either have to rely more on fossil fuels to make up the difference or import energy from other states at high prices. Exelon wants to close the plants because they say the energy market is unfair and not profitable. So they're seeking nearly $700 million worth of state subsidies to keep them open. And the state subsidies for the utility company could result in higher electricity prices for customers. Lynn says the school district and families probably feel the weights of the time limit more than politicians writing the legislation. But that doesn't mean their state lawmakers have ignored Byron. She says representatives like Tom Demmer and Dave Vella have been helpful through the process. Local organizers will continue holding events to help raise awareness and get the bill passed. But there are only weeks to spare, and lawmakers could be called to Springfield any day to vote on the plan to decide the future of green energy in Illinois. I'm Peter Medlin.
Business groups and organized labor are doubling down on their opposition to Governor Pritzker's plan to transition Illinois to 100% clean energy in the next three decades. The governor's plan hinges on shuttering coal and natural gas-fired power plants by 2035, or 10 years later if technology advances, to allow for trapping much more greenhouse gases than currently possible. But Illinois Pipe Trades Association Legislative Director Rick Turvin says his union members who staff those plants will end up losing out.
We know the energy sector is rapidly changing and understand the need to transition to cleaner power in Illinois. However, the current proposal is so aggressive and unrealistic in forcing plant closures, it will cause unnecessary pain for many workers, businesses, and communities across the state.
Environmental groups and the governor say they won't back down on so-called decarbonization in order to get Illinois to 100% clean energy by the year 2050. For now, groups negotiating the energy deal say they're at a stalemate. The Biden administration wants to significantly cut greenhouse gas emissions over the next decade. Renewable fuels are part of that plan, but some researchers say ethanol doesn't help that much. But as Katie Pikus with Harvest Public Media explains, the ethanol industry says it's taking steps that could make it more of a player in slowing climate change.
Millions of Americans fill their car up with gas like I am today. I'm filling it up with gasoline that has 10% ethanol. But the Biden administration has proposed a lot of money for electric vehicles and charging stations.
And so ethanol doesn't have a big role to play.
Jonathan Lewis is senior counsel of the nonprofit Clean Air Task Force. He says the expansion of corn to meet the demands of food, feed, and transportation markets converts more land into farmland.
And as you turn that land over, you release soil carbon from the ground where it's not impacting climate into the atmosphere where it is, where it's contributing to climate change.
The ethanol industry has long been at odds with some climate groups and activists over how good their fuel is for the environment. Ethanol is made from corn, which naturally pulls carbon dioxide from the air. But when it's produced and burned, it releases CO2 and small amounts of two other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Jason Hill is a biosystems engineer at the University of Minnesota.
When you look at the full life cycle of production and use of ethanol compared to gasoline, it has not been shown that corn ethanol actually reduces greenhouse gas emissions.
Hill says that's because greenhouse gases are also released growing corn and distributing ethanol, not just during fermentation. The science surrounding ethanol's emissions and how much better it is than gasoline is tricky and often debated. But some say that could be changing. Todd Becker is the CEO of Green Plains Incorporated. The biofuels company has 8 ethanol plants that are part of a big project to capture the carbon dioxide released when ethanol is made.
We're being pushed from all sides. The consumer wants lower carbon. The companies we do business with want lower carbon. Our investors want us to lower carbon, our carbon footprint.
The project involves 30 ethanol plants in Nebraska, Iowa, and 3 other states. They would capture carbon dioxide off of fermentation before the greenhouse gas is released into the air. They'll pipe it to North Dakota to be stored permanently underground. Becker calls it a game changer for the U.S. ethanol industry.
This is the precursor to, I think, greater acceptance of the products that we make, whether it's in our fuel, like ethanol that we make, or in our proteins, like high-value proteins.
Robert Brown heads Iowa State University's Bioeconomy Institute. He says carbon capture could be key to changing perceptions about the ethanol industry.
I think we're at a real interesting cusp in technology.
Brown says capturing that carbon dioxide and storing it underground puts ethanol on the path to becoming what's called carbon negative energy. So it's taking more carbon out of the atmosphere than it's putting in. He says that can make ethanol better than electric vehicles.
So anything the ethanol industry can do to reduce that footprint, the better, the more attractive they will be as a sustainable source of energy.
The Clean Air Task Force supports carbon capture tech, but Jonathan Lewis says he doesn't think corn ethanol can get all of the carbon dioxide out of transportation.
We're going to need to shift to other fuels and other systems, mainly hydrogen and electricity.
Todd Becker of Green Plains says he doesn't fear electric vehicles cutting into the demand for ethanol anytime soon. And he says Green Plains will continue to work on lowering its carbon footprint.
And I'm confident that this will be the time going forward that somebody will understand the importance of ethanol production, not only to the U.S. agricultural economy, but to the emissions that come out of the tailpipe of our vehicles.
Becker says ethanol still has a role to play as a solution to climate change. But the question is, how big a role? Katie Pikus, Harvest Public Media.
Students not showing up for school and failing went up this year in Chicago public high schools, especially those in critical grades that set the stage for graduation. Now educators are trying to prevent this pandemic year from having long-term devastating impacts on students. From Chicago, Sarah Karp reports.
Last year when the pandemic shut down schools, Christopher was doing fairly well. He was a freshman at Kelly High School on the southwest side of the city.
You know, I was getting A's and B's and maybe some C's.
But now Christopher is ending his sophomore year, trying to get his grades up in a desperate attempt not to fail any more classes.
I'm going to give it my all and then some. I'm like turning in the works I've never did or doing some more stuff I've never done.
Christopher is not alone. A WBEZ analysis of CPS attendance and grade data shows some alarming trends at the 40 high schools with the highest poverty rates. Failure at these schools in important subjects like math and English were up significantly this fall. And by the third quarter of the spring, 20% of all grades earned by freshmen and sophomores in these classes were Fs. Absenteeism in these schools jumped by 9 percentage points this year. And here's the thing. Research shows that students who fail just one semester in their freshman year have a much greater risk of not making it to graduation.
And that's what makes me really, really concerned.
Alex Ziskin runs the University of Chicago's 2-and-Through Project. It works with Chicago Public Schools to use data to increase graduation rates and college completion. What makes it even more troubling, Ziskin says, is that in the past, students who are off track were usually failing just one class. But now, many more are failing all their classes.
It's going to be a real challenge, I think, to re-engage those students in school because they haven't really been in school, at least freshmen haven't been in school since eighth grade. We're asking them to come back as sophomores now with, you know, very few credits and, you know, already behind.
Meanwhile, some teachers are agonizing over giving students Fs during a year of the pandemic and civil unrest. Chicago Public Schools lets out for the summer this week, and teachers are asking themselves, should I just pass students? How much makeup work should I have asked for? If I pass them, will they be okay next year? Christopher is the kind of kid that teachers are thinking about. Not a superstar, not a slacker. What really hooked him at school freshman year was a Dungeons & Dragons club he started with his friends to play the game. He thought it was really cool.
I think I was, like, avoiding missing school.
Once school was shut down, the club also ended. Christopher suffered depression in the past, and it came back big time.
It made me lean back into what I was before, you know, I got help. You know, I was saying, like, to myself more often. I didn't want to do anything. You know, I didn't want to talk to anyone. I was kind of to myself again.
Not all students came into the pandemic diagnosed with mental health issues. But during it, many of them say they became depressed or just unmotivated. Others had to take jobs to help their families financially or were preoccupied with watching brothers and sisters while their parents worked. At one point, Christopher found he just couldn't do school.
Because I was already mentally exhausted.
He says he didn't log in for an entire week.
Then, right, I had like this huge amount of work that I had to do and I was like, I should not have taken that break.
His dad would have liked to help him again, but had been laid off and couldn't afford a therapist.
I could see the stress in my dad's eyes. I was like, okay, yeah, this is awful.
Christopher says teachers would ask students if they were okay. They'd call and they'd email, but it was all just too easy to ignore. Anna Lane is one of those teachers. She teaches social studies to sophomores at Kelly.
Our numbers are difficult to look at in terms of what we label as academic success, right?
It's a really hard situation. On one hand, she's sympathetic to students and all the stress they've been under. On the other,
I struggle with this with terms of my principles and what I expect students to do, because when we don't hold students accountable and we don't expect them to do work, then they won't do work for us, right? So that's like the battle that I have every day. Yeah. Like, come on, guys, give me something, right? You're capable of giving me something.
Lane says she and other teachers are already thinking about how this year could bleed into next year. Mental health services, she says, are key, but also the understanding that some students are totally out of the practice of going to school every day and doing homework. Aldrich McCain works with almost 20 high schools in the city and says the debate and hand-wringing at Kelly High School is happening in all of them. The Network for College Success helps schools who support the critical freshman and sophomore years.
But I know that some people are overwhelmed, and a lot of them overwhelmed. The magnitude of both the problem and the all of the pieces that go into this problem.
Christopher is one of the relatively few high school students in Chicago who went back for in-person learning. He went to Kelly on Thursdays and Fridays this spring.
Oh, it's wonderful. Most of the teachers are more considerate. You know, most of them are, like, giving you assignments that can either help your grade, you know, increase it for, like, you know, B to an A, or, you know, an F to a D or C.
Christopher wants to do well and maybe eventually go to college to be a therapist to help other kids. But what about other students who are not motivated at all? Come next fall, they'll be far behind. Chicago Public School officials acknowledge this is a serious problem. They plan to invest millions of COVID relief dollars in academic supports, healing centers, and tutoring for students. But the experts like McCain have some other suggestions. Going forward, it should not just be about passing students or making grades about punishing them. Instead, the focus should be on making sure students have the knowledge they need to actually succeed. And in policy and practice, the school district should operate with grace and compassion. Sarah Karp, WBEZ News.
You're listening to Statewide. We'll be right back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, it's hard to get good help these days. They're finding that out, especially at restaurants. And how has that impacted those who are showing up to work? We'll have that story. That's on the way. Earlier this year, the group Stop Asian American Pacific Islander Hate released its report showing that in the year after the COVID-19 pandemic hit, harassment, physical attacks, and other kinds of discrimination against those racial ethnic groups rose dramatically. Sunyan Chomoro is the executive director of the Chicago-based National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. She says it comes as no surprise Asian Pacific American women are the targets of the discriminatory behavior. Her organization's own study showed that nearly 80% of women in those groups reported having experienced hate incidents. And this comes after 6 Asian American women died in a shooting at an Atlanta, Georgia spa earlier this year. She spoke with Maureen McKinney.
There's been a marked increase in incidents of hate against Asian American women. Did COVID play a role in that?
Yeah, so I think the frequency and like the severity of the day-to-day harassment and violence we're seeing on the streets is definitely, have been intensified since the beginning of the pandemic. And because of the, in the last 15 months. And, you know, I would say that many of us experience sort of the verbal harassment of being called China virus or to go home and take our virus home. I mean, I've definitely experienced that a number of times walking around. And so that's clearly related to the pandemic. But I would say that some of the, the shootings that happened in Indiana that was targeting the Sikh community and the shootings that happened in Atlanta that were targeting the Asian American women, maybe the pandemic has something to do with it, but it was much clearer that these were committed by men that had long held views about whether it's white supremacist views or about, you know, viewing Asian American women as sex workers, you know, it was more than the pandemic, right? So I think, you know, there are a couple of different things that are happening at the same time.
I do want to also just elaborate on a little bit is the fact this issue of Asian American women experiencing harassment, you know, it really, the start of it wasn't the pandemic. And of course, I'm talking about obviously back in history to 1875, but even after that, with, you know, the way media portrays Asian American women, there's this hypersexualization and fetishization of Asian American women bodies that had continued. And then I would say that really, you know, with Donald Trump becoming president and sort of normalizing some misogynistic behavior and talk, we did see an increase of street harassment of women in general then as well, right? So this sudden uptick in harassment of Asian American women really did start when, you know, that Hollywood Access video was leaked and Donald Trump still became president and kind of, you know, emboldened men to behave the way they do in public. That is obviously behaving in these ways that are harassing women. And so I want to put that into context because I think it's important for us to remember that, like, even though we're talking about racialized harassment that's becoming so prevalent because of the pandemic, that in the intersection of race and gender, Asian American women have been experiencing harassment and, you know, racialized sexual harassment even before that.
Asian American women reported more hate incidents than men. Why?
Well, I mean, I think it's a combination of a couple of things, right? That women in general receive street harassment, experience street harassment a lot more than men do. And then you layer that with race, and I think Asian American women become, you know, targets for many people. I would say that I think it also doesn't help that there's sort of the stereotype about Asian American women that, you know, we're quiet and docile and submissive, and, you know, we don't really, you know, fight back or, you know, make a lot of noise. And I think those stereotypes also play into who they decide they're going to target as victims of their harassment. So, you know, so I think there are a number of different things that play again here.
There's a long-standing history, right, of poor treatment of Asian American women. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. So, you know, Asian American women have been experiencing discrimination, you know, almost from the time that we showed up, you know, in the United States, you know, and on the record. So back in 1875, there was a piece of legislation that was passed called the Page Act of 1875. And essentially what that did was ban East Asian women from coming to the United States because we were assumed to be prostitutes. So they didn't want, you know, Asian American women coming. The full context of that is that, you know, the Chinese workers were coming to the United States to work mainly on the railroads out west and were being recruited in droves because it was, you know, hard labor work, and, you know, they wanted to find more labor. And so obviously when you have workers migrating, they bring families, they bring their wives, their sisters, their mothers, and the United States was starting to get concerned about the increase in the Chinese American population. And so this was their attempt to curb the population growth, right, by excluding the women. And so off the bat, it's written in the book officially that, you know, the reason Asian women were excluded was because we were perceived to be prostitutes. So from the get-go, of our history here, we have been viewed as this, you know, sex object. That those were the very words of the murderer in Atlanta, right? He said he wanted to eliminate his sexual temptations. And it very much resonates what the rationale was for passing the PAGE Act in 1875.
Can you elaborate a little on the issue of intersectionality and how it applies here?
Over 70% of those reporting the crime or incidences are women victims. And so you cannot separate that gender is playing a role in what's going on, right? That gender plays a role in the fact that we are being targeted. And often, you know, our encounters around public harassment is a combination of some racial slur with a sexist slur, right? You know, even pre-pandemic, I think many of us, the way we experience sexual harassment on the street, especially, was racialized, right? Like, we're targeted not only because we're women, but specifically because we're Asian American women. And so I think it is hard to separate the violence and the harassment that we experience to separate that it's only a racial issue or only a gender issue.
Sunyan Shomoro is the executive director of the Chicago-based National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. You can find a link to the group's latest report at statewideshow.com. Well, there was a positive this week in Illinois, which saw zero COVID deaths on Monday, the first time in 16 months that the state's health department reported no deaths due to the virus. But the so-called Delta variant is spreading, and southwestern Illinois is seeing its effects. Hannah Meisel has more.
New COVID cases, hospitalizations, and deaths in Illinois have slowed significantly in the last month, leading to zero deaths reported Monday. But to Illinois' west, Missouri leads the nation in new cases per capita, driven by the more contagious Delta variant. And Illinois' three EMS regions that border Missouri have seen a sharp uptick in its COVID cases, too. The Metro East is experiencing its highest test positivity rate since early February. Governor J.B. Pritzker is urging unvaccinated Illinoisans to get their COVID shots.
The Delta variant gets people sicker faster, and that's very disconcerting. But if you're vaccinated, you're very well protected.
Nearly 70% of Illinoisans 12 and over who are eligible for the vaccine have had at least one dose. I'm Hannah Meisel.
Many restaurants have been forced to close during prime dining hours due to a shortage of workers this spring and summer. That's happened in many cities, including Peoria. Managing and serving in restaurants is more challenging than ever for those who have stayed on with their positions in the food industry. From member station WCBU, Jordan Mead reports.
A host at Tequila's Mexican Bar and Grill, who asked for her name to be withheld so that she could speak candidly, says it is hard on one's mental health to work long hours due to the shortage of restaurant workers.
The cooks, they're literally here all day from 9 a.m. till 11 p.m. sometimes. They don't really get to go home. They don't get to see their families. We don't really get to eat that much or, like, rest.
The host also says many customers verbally mistreated the workers during the pandemic, becoming frustrated at Tequila's Mexican Bar and Grill workers for enforcing strict COVID-19 policies while also balancing a shortage of employees.
Some people cuss at us, some people just leave. I would say for people to be more considerate, to actually treat food service employees like people.
Kendall Bradshaw, general manager at Jersey Mike's Subs, also says there are several resulting complications from being low staff, and he has picked up a great deal of the responsibility.
If I don't have somebody that can cover the shift or show up for the shift, I would have to take it. During the pandemic, a lot of times I was the only reason the store was opening every day. So as far as trying to find workers, there seems like there's some interest out there for work, but just not quality workers. And I think that's really been a big hit for us.
Bradshaw says the pandemic positively changed the procedures at Jersey Mike's, and he encourages people to follow the CDC guidelines and trust that restaurants are not in safe environments to work or dine in, given their safety precautions.
The pandemic brought about a change in how people clean and how seriously they take cleanliness, and I think that's actually really helped our restaurant because now we're really paying attention, really focusing on the cleaning aspect.
Former server and current manager Maddie Farney began working at Uncle Bob's homemade ice cream during the pandemic, and she says it's hard to please every customer because of the limited number of employees and because of the busyness.
The customers have to recognize, oh, there is a really long line outside, or they are really busy right now, and I need to be patient, and I'll get my food when I get it. And it's not that we're purposefully taking long to make their food, just that we have a lot of people to see, and we're doing our best to do it as fast and as good as we can.
Farney went on to say that she has always enjoyed working in the food industry, and she continues to enjoy it even with the recent demands and lack of employees.
I will say it is definitely nice staying busy. I'm not going to complain that we've been busier because nobody wants to be slow when you work at a restaurant, but it is very hectic and it puts a lot of pressure on not only employees but also like the managers of the business.
Todd Hahulin, owner of Touche, considers himself very lucky. All of his staff members stuck by his side through the pandemic. The main challenge Touche is currently facing is product supply.
So we're just really looking forward to a day where maybe the supply chain for food and products can kind of equalize and balance out, and so we can kind of not have to deal with that anymore. But outside of that, we're just really thankful to be up and going again and serving people like we did before the pandemic.
Hahulin says all of his staff members are vaccinated and they feel confident that they will be safe working in the upcoming months. While each restaurant has different experiences, everyone is hopeful that more individuals will choose to apply for positions soon to shore up staffing issues. Restaurant workers on the job today hope that soon things can return to normal.
Jordan Mead with that report from Peoria. Students getting that college acceptance letter are often happy when they open it. But next up, the story of a student from the Bloomington Normal region and his family who had that moment captured on video. Ryan Denham reports it also captured a lot of hearts.
20-year-old Kurt Kinley went viral over the 4th of July weekend with a video on Twitter showing him excitedly opening up his admission letter from Heartland Community College. Kurt, who has Down syndrome, was accepted into a 2-year program at Heartland that he'll start in the fall.
I'm in! Yeah!
Like many young people with intellectual or developmental disabilities, college was no guarantee for Kurt. But the Unit 5 grad chased it, in part because of his older brother, Glenn, and sister, Kelsey, who both went off to school themselves. Here's his father, Dave.
He's always wanted to be, and I'm going to tear up, he's always wanted to be like his older brother and sister. Yeah. They've been incredible role models.
Big brother Glenn now lives in Kansas, and he's the one who posted Kurt's video on Twitter. Glenn says college can be an easy thing to take for granted.
And I just always assumed that I would go to college. I think my parents probably even always assumed I would go to college. I don't know that Kurt ever assumed he would go to college. It's a pretty big deal for him, you know. He was pretty fired up about it, and I think people just, like, realized that.
Kurt's success is maybe not that surprising, given his family, which leans heavily on their Christian faith. Kurt was adopted and had extensive medical issues as a kid. But the Kinleys learned quickly not to count out Kurt. His mother, Michelle, is a special education teacher.
There were things where I would say, oh, no, Kurt won't do that, or Kurt won't do this, and eventually he would. So we learned early on to not limit that. And our expectations for him have always been high as far as behavior expectations, social expectations. And I think that's helped him, that he's not allowed to just go act like a goofball someplace because that's what he feels like.
His brother Glenn says that is what put college within reach.
They never assumed that he couldn't do anything. And I think with kids with special needs, unfortunately, a lot of times it is assumed that they won't do certain things or that they can't do certain things, and that assumption was thrown out the window.
Kurt will enroll this fall in the Heartland Academy for Learning Opportunities program, or HALO, that recently celebrated 10 years in operation. It's geared at students between 18 and 28 with intellectual and/or developmental disabilities and other learning challenges. Courses cover computers and math, cooking and money skills, and other aspects of independent living. It probably won't take long for Kurt to make some new friends at Heartland, as his family says he's a bit of a social butterfly. He works 2 jobs at a Bloomington Normal bakery and a trampoline park, and is a huge Blackhawks fan.
He has brought so much joy, more than you could ever imagine. I mean, we could be on here for hours and I could tell you stories, because that video is really just, you know, that's just 1%, less than that, of what he is every day.
That video, filmed a couple of weeks ago, already has nearly 200,000 views. Glenn says some of the most touching feedback he's heard has been from a parent of someone with special needs who now felt encouraged about them going to college too. As for Kurt, that reaction was 100% genuine.
He talks a lot, and I think that was one of the few moments when he was kind of speechless.
You can learn more about Heartland's HALO program at heartland.edu/HALO. I'm Ryan Denham.
Still ahead, we'll tell you about a pioneer in workplace safety, the story of Alice Hamilton. That's next on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Chicago's factories were booming in the early 1900s, but conditions inside were terrible. It was often dirty, with little ventilation, and exposure to dangerous chemicals was common. But today we have all kinds of laws aimed at providing a safe workplace. There was a woman whose groundbreaking work is a big reason many of these laws exist. Her name was Alice Hamilton. And it's likely you've never even heard of her, although she helped save millions of lives. So what was Alice Hamilton's impact on Chicago, the state of Illinois, and around the country? Our friends at WBEZ delved into her story for their podcast, Curious City. And here's reporter Edie Rabinowitz.
Yes, we've come a long way in the last half century.
In this 1950s interview, the announcer is introducing his guest, a trailblazing scientist, particularly when it came to safety in the industrial workplace, Alice Hamilton.
Dr. Hamilton, who visited chemical factories where dangerous sulfuric acid bubbled in...
She took on leaders of industries, and the industries themselves.
Walked through munition plants choking with the deadly fumes of nitric acid. Who spoke out against conditions that were causing lead and carbon monoxide poisoning.
Alice Hamilton would spend her life investigating those industries, even exposing herself to workplace toxins with the goal of protecting workers. She was one of the country's first researchers to examine problems associated with lead poisoning, an issue we're still dealing with now. Her interest in helping people started when she was a young girl. Alice grew up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, where she was homeschooled and raised in a civically and intellectually engaged environment.
They would oftentimes have their lessons in the morning, and then the afternoon, they would go out on their own initiative and reenact stories that they'd been reading about.
Matthew Ringenberg is the co-author of a biography of Alice Hamilton. He says the family was so civically minded that Hamilton's mother had even befriended prominent suffragettes like Susan B. Anthony, who would stay at the house when she was in town. Alice and her siblings were all raised to serve a purpose higher than themselves, sometimes at the cost of foregoing a family of their own.
So this idea that, one, women could do big things, and two, that because of their position in life, they had a real responsibility to serve, find meaningful ways to serve the world, were both embedded.
So Alice thought the way she could make a difference would be to become a doctor. As she wrote in her autobiography, "I chose medicine, not because I was scientifically minded, for I was deeply ignorant of science. I chose it because as a doctor, I could go anywhere I pleased, to far-off lands or to city slums, and be quite sure that I could be of use anywhere." This would mean going to medical school, but there was a problem. Alice hadn't been taught any science at home. Her dad didn't believe Alice or her brother and sisters needed science. But she didn't let this stop her. She convinced her dad to get her a tutor to teach her physics and chemistry, and she took classes in anatomy at the local medical school. Eventually, she got accepted into med school at the University of Michigan. When she was in med school, there were only 4,500 women physicians in all of the U.S. They were pioneers.
And they were the first generation of women who had access to higher education and the professions. And that always seemed surprising to my students who didn't think women had done anything before the 1960s or 70s.
That's Barbara Sisherman, author of Alice Hamilton, A Life in Letters. It's a compilation of more than 100 letters Alice Hamilton wrote about her life.
Actually, these women had a great deal of success in the political world as well as in medicine and in academe.
Sisherman says after graduating medical school, Alice had to figure out what to do. She wanted to be a scientist rather than practice medicine, but there weren't a lot of opportunities. Eventually, she landed a teaching job at Northwestern. She was also living at Hull House, the settlement home in Chicago led by progressive reformer Jane Addams. It provided all kinds of services to immigrants and the poor. But she struggled at first at Hull House. She didn't feel like her expertise was useful or that she was meeting her own high standards. In one letter she wrote, "It got quite bad, and I had to go and hide myself for fear I would cry if somebody spoke to me." Eventually, biographer Sisherman says, Alice was able to begin to find her footing and purpose at Hull House by using her medical skills. She taught mothers about good hygiene for their babies. And this is when she really began what would become her life's work, applying science to help correct political, industrial, and societal injustices. Remember, in the early 1900s, checks on corporate and governmental wrongdoings were hard to come by. Sisherman says Hamilton got interested in industrial poisons.
She saw people, men in the neighborhood in particular, getting sick.
What she saw troubled her deeply. So Alice began conducting her own scientific investigations. For example, in Chicago in 1902, there was a terrible outbreak of typhoid, a bacterial infection that can be deadly. Nobody knew where the disease came from or how it was spreading so fast. Alice began to roam the neighborhood to try to determine the source of the outbreak, documenting the unsanitary conditions she saw, including raw sewage with swarms of flies. Alice was so dogged in this kind of work, she became known for her shoe leather epidemiology, wearing down one's shoe bottoms by walking, in her case, making visits to homes, hospitals, even saloons. One place where she had her work cut out for her was a factory.
She called it the worst place of employment that she ever investigated.
Alice Hamilton had earned such a reputation for her scientific research and that shoe leather epidemiology that bigwigs downstate began to take notice. So much so that in 1910, the governor of Illinois appointed her to lead the newly formed Illinois Commission on Occupational Diseases. The commission was assigned to research toxins in factories. Alice's work with the commission focused on several toxins, including lead, a toxin she kept encountering in her factory visits, and a toxin that still haunts Chicago today. Again, biographer Matthew Ringenberg.
If you're crushing lead or you're burning it or you have lead dust and you're pouring it onto some surface so that it could melt on there, there would be clouds of lead dust. And that's what the workers worked in the entire day.
Ringenberg explained that the lead dust permeated everything, even the workers' sandwiches. Workers had no masks and just wore their regular clothes. The factories were poorly ventilated. There were really no rules about lead. Author Sisherman points out that nobody understood that lead exposure could lead to illness, so nobody was paying attention to the problem. This was a challenge for Alice.
She said initially, it's like making one's way into a jungle, because nobody really knew what to correlate disease and work conditions.
The hospitals were of little use.
Even just deciding who had lead poisoning and who didn't was difficult. There were extreme cases, but medical records were relatively rare. Hospital records were rare.
And the companies forcing people to work in these toxic environments? Well, it's as if they just flat out didn't care.
So she really had to go and corral people because the factory people didn't really want her to investigate these things.
And she didn't stop there. Here she is, years ago, talking about one encounter she had with a factory owner who showed little regard for their workers' safety. She told them they were poisoning their workers, and more.
I remember talking to a manufacturer of white lead, and he was a very fine man. He was really a philanthropist. But he said to me, "Do you mean to say that if a man gets lead poisoning in my plant, I'm to be held responsible?"
Yes, yes, that's precisely what Alice meant. And she encountered this often, including when she visited one of the factories of the National Lead Company, which was run by a man named Edward Cornish.
She called it the worst place of employment that she ever investigated.
That's biographer Matthew Ringenberg again. He says Alice wasn't afraid to confront Cornish or any number of company heads for that matter, and she would sometimes use her charm to disarm them.
He was one of those who expected nothing but compliments and was very defensive and said, okay, fine. If you can prove to me that my workers are dying, because I don't think they are, I'll make changes. And he even asked, like, there's a workman passing the office, he said, come in here. Is this workplace poisoning you? And of course he says no. And she points this out to him. It's like, yes, he'd like to keep his job. He needs to have a paycheck.
Ellis was persuasive. She came back to Cornish with proof of what was happening to his employees.
So she did, throughout the course of her investigation, both in his factory specifically, but also statewide, showed that a lot of these men, they were dying. They were neurological damage, digestive system damage, and sometimes insanity, and many of them died.
She prescribed a series of changes needed to make the factory safer for employees. And finally,
a year and a half later, she came back, and he personally shows her around the factory and shows her all the things he had done to make it a safer work environment. And she was so pleased and a bit surprised, because he'd been one of the most antagonistic and he'd run one of the worst factories, but he cleaned it up, and she referred to it as one of the top three or four factories that she investigated a second time around. So occasionally you'd have these stories where it made a huge difference.
Ellis continued to investigate the connections between factory poisons and disease. Nadia Moraga, a museum educator at Hull House, says these studies led to major legislative reforms, and not just in Illinois.
The work that she did formed the foundation for the majority of labor reform that was happening at that time. Because here she was doing the toxicology work and these inspections of these workspaces themselves.
And Moraga says Alice's scientific research and advocacy had a long-term impact.
Behind the scenes, she was also involved in changes in legislation. She was involved in committees on state and national levels that were creating these very large-scale changes in workers' rights and experiences.
Alice's work with the Illinois Commission earned her a national reputation. In 1911, the federal government asked her to conduct a national study on lead in industry. Alice became the top expert in the country on workplace toxins. Later, looking back on her work of those days, even the relentlessly modest Alice admitted her work was groundbreaking. She said, everything I discovered was new, and most of it was really valuable. And that was just the first half of her life. She would do much more. Here are a few highlights. At the age of 50, she went on to become the first woman appointed to the faculty at Harvard University, though they wouldn't give her football tickets or let her march in graduation. She retired at the age of 66, and while her investigation slowed down, her activism did not. She was outspoken against McCarthyism and the Vietnam War. That outspokenness earned her an FBI file that wasn't closed until she was 96. Alice died in 1970 at age 101. 3 months later, President Nixon signed the legislation that led to the creation of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, or OSHA. Many say Hamilton's work was the key to the creation of that agency, which recently marked its 50th anniversary. Joseph Chip Hughes of OSHA says that he and others at the agency are inspired by Alice, especially during this pandemic that has taken the lives of so many frontline and essential workers.
The legacy of Alice Hamilton is something that has been a kind of North Star for us in occupational safety and health, because she singularly focused on shedding light onto a problem that had been ignored or just not dealt with or not cared about.
And as Alice herself said at the age of 88, for me, the satisfaction is that things are better now, and I had some part of it. By the way, This episode was based on a question we got from Julia Flora Carlson. She actually got so interested in Alice after visiting the Hull House Museum that she ended up doing a lot more research about her for a class project. She even won a History Fair award for it. Now she's a biochemistry major in college at Notre Dame with an interest in public health.
That's reporter Edie Rabinowitz, and we thank WBEZ and their Curious City podcast for that segment on Alice Hamilton. That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. We'll be back next time with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. This episode and past episodes are available at statewideshow.com. You can also find our weekly podcast through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.